Oh wait, I want to start today in the resuscitation bay. Let's just picture the scene. It's maybe 2:00 a.m.
Always 2:00 a.m.
It is always 2:00 a.m. The automatic doors slide open and the paramedics are wheeling in a gurney, and it's chaotic. You've got a patient who's been seizing a big generalized tonic-clonic seizure for maybe 20 minutes. The family is of course terrified, the medics are sweating, and the patient is just completely unresponsive.
Right, the postictal state. The
Okay.
storm itself has passed,
Yeah.
but the brain is essentially offline. It's rebooting.
Exactly. They're groggy. Maybe they're a bit combative if they're starting to wake up, but mostly they are just out of it. So the whole medical team swarms the bed.
Sure.
IV lines go in, monitors get hooked up, airway gets checked.
Yeah.
And as part of that standard, welcome to the ER package, they draw blood.
Standard protocol. You absolutely have to. You need to know electrolytes, glucose, kidney function. You need a complete snapshot of the body's metabolism right at that moment.
Exactly. So the blood goes off to the lab. Maybe 30 minutes later, the results pop up on the computer screen. And there's one number that's like blinking red. It sets off every single alarm bell in the doctor's head.
The WBC.
The white blood cell count, the WBC, is, let's say, 25,000.
Which is massive. I mean, just for context for everyone listening, a normal healthy range is usually somewhere between what, 4,000 and 10,000 cells per cubic millimeter. So 25,000 is, well, it's a lot.
It's huge. So you're the doctor on shift. You see a patient who's basically comatose and a white count of 25,000. Where does your brain go immediately?
Infection. Without a single hesitation, it screams sepsis, it screams meningitis, it screams pneumonia.
Why? What's the logic?
The dogma, the thing that's drilled into us, is that white blood cells are the soldiers of the immune system. So if the army is mobilized in force, there must be an invader. There has to be a bug
Well,
somewhere.
and that one assumption, that one number, it triggers a whole cascade of decisions, doesn't it?
Absolutely. A cascade that can be very invasive and costly. You might immediately start broad-spectrum antibiotics, the real heavy hitters, just in case.
The shotgun approach.
Exactly. You might order a CT scan of the chest. You're hunting for pneumonia.
Yeah.
You might even decide to do a lumbar puncture, a spinal tap, where you stick a needle into their spine to check the fluid for meningitis.
Yeah.
You go on a hunt for bacteria.
Because the thinking is the infection caused a fever, the fever caused the seizure, or maybe the infection has, God forbid, crossed into the brain itself.
Right. It's a logical, if sometimes flawed, pathway. But here's the problem. You do the spinal tap, it's clean.
Okay.
You do the CT scan. The lungs look okay. You culture the blood, you culture the urine, nothing grows. You have this massive mobilized army of white blood cells, but there's no enemy to be found.
You're chasing a ghost.
You are. And while the whole team is busy chasing that ghost, they might be completely missing what that number is actually trying to tell them.
That is the mystery we are unpacking today. What if that high white blood cell count isn't about infection at all? What if it has absolutely nothing to do with bacteria or viruses? What if that number is actually a sort of coded message from the lungs telling us just how close that patient came to suffocating?
That is the core question, the absolute heart of the study we're diving into today. It suggests we've been reading the scoreboard wrong, maybe for decades.
We are looking at a paper titled "The Magnitude of Post-Convulsive Leukocytosis Mirrors the Severity of Paraconvulsive Respiratory Compromise." It was published back in 2019 in Frontiers in Neurology by Jose L. Vega and his team.
It is a dense title for sure, but it's also incredibly precise. It's not just suggesting a link. It's proposing that the immune system and the respiratory system are locked in this kind of violent dance during a seizure. And if you know the steps to that dance, you can predict how much danger the patient is really in.
Before we get into the data itself, which I honestly found shocking, we really need to break down the language here because that title uses two very specific, very medical phrases: post-convulsive leukocytosis and periconvulsive respiratory compromise. Let's start with the first one, post-convulsive leukocytosis.
Sure. Let's just break it down. Leukocytosis is just the fancy medical term for a high white blood cell count.
Yeah.
Post-convulsive means after the convulsion. So simply put, it's a spike in white cells after a seizure.
Is this a new discovery? I mean, did Vega's team just stumble upon this?
Oh, no, not at all, actually. We've known about this phenomenon for a long, long time. The study itself points out that this happens in a huge percentage of seizure cases.
How huge!
Well, they cite that about 63% of patients with status epilepticus, those really dangerous nonstop seizures, they show this spike.
Wow. Okay, so that's more than half. That's a majority.
Way more. And this is really interesting. That number drops to only about 7% in what are called complex partial seizures. Those are seizures where you might be confused, you might stare off into space, but you aren't physically thrashing around on the floor.
So there's something about the physical violence of the convulsion itself that seems to matter.
It seems to be a key ingredient. The full body generalized seizure is what triggers this response in a big way.
Okay, so we know the cells go up. That's the post-CL, or post-convulsive leukocytosis, part of the paper. Now let's look at the other side of the coin. Paraconvulsive respiratory compromise.
Right, and this is the really scary part of the equation. Paraconvulsive just means happening around the time of the seizure. So during it or immediately after. And respiratory compromise is a very polite clinical way of saying the patient is struggling to breathe. Or not breathing at all.
The study lists some specific symptoms here. Apnea, tachypnea, hypopnea. Can you just translate those for us?
Sure. Apnea is the most severe. It's when breathing stops completely. The chest just isn't moving. No air in, no air out.
Okay.
Tachypnea is the opposite, in a way. It's rapid, but really ineffective breathing, almost like panting. You're not getting deep breaths. Hypopnea is shallow breathing, where you just aren't moving enough air to clear out carbon dioxide and bring in oxygen. And ultimately, all of these lead to desaturation low oxygen levels in the blood.
The visuals they describe pulling from the actual medical charts they're haunting. The researchers found notes like labored breathing or lips turn blue or just gasping for air.
It's visceral, isn't it? This isn't just a number on a monitor beeping. This is a human body starved of oxygen fighting for its life.
So historically, we have these two separate events. We have a patient who stopped breathing during the seizure. That's problem A. And we have a patient with a high white blood cell count. That's problem B. And usually doctors thought of these as two separate, unrelated problems.
Exactly. The lungs stopped working because the seizure clamped up the chest muscles and the white count is high. Well, maybe they have a cold or some other low-grade infection we can't find. Two independent variables,
yeah,
randomly associated.
But Vega and his team asked a really radical question. What if they aren't independent? What if the reason the white cells are so high is because the breathing was so bad?
It's a hypothesis that connects the mechanical violence of the seizure to the deep cellular response happening in the blood. It's a bridge between two worlds.
To test this, they did a massive retrospective chart review. And I want to pause on the methodology for a second because, you know, I usually roll my eyes a little at retrospective studies. It can sometimes feel like just reading old diary entries and trying to find a pattern after the fact.
It can be messy, yes. You are completely at the mercy of what other doctors wrote down, sometimes years ago.
Yeah.
But in this case, the way they filtered the data is what makes this so powerful.
Right. They started with 446 patients at a big tertiary care hospital in North Carolina. But they didn't use all of them, did they?
Not even close. They threw out nearly two-thirds of the data.
That seems like a lot to discard.
They had to. They were absolutely ruthless with their exclusion criteria. And this is the key to the whole study. If you want to prove that the seizure itself caused the white blood cell spike, you have to eliminate every single other possible cause. You have to remove all the noise.
So give me an example. If a patient came into the ER with a seizure, but they also had a fever and a cough.
Excluded. Immediately. Could be pneumonia, and pneumonia raises your white count. It's a confounder.
Okay. What if they had HIV?
Excluded. HIV fundamentally alters the baseline immune system. Can't use that data.
Cancer. Or someone on chemotherapy.
Gone. Both gone. Chemo, as we know, wipes out white blood cells. Certain cancers can make them skyrocket. They also excluded anyone on chronic steroids because steroids can artificially inflate your white blood cell count.
So they basically just kept whittling this list down and down until they were left with 152 patients who were, medically speaking, clean, aside from their seizure disorder.
Exactly. They wanted the purest signal they could possibly find. They only wanted patients who had generalized epileptic convulsions, the big ones, and who shouldn't have any other reason to have weird blood work.
Okay, so they have their pure cohort, 152 patients. Then they divided them into groups. Group A, the people who definitely had trouble breathing, the paraconvulsive respiratory compromise group. And group B, the people who, according to the charts, kept breathing just fine.
Correct. They called them the PCRC plus and PCRC minus groups.
And then they just looked at the blood work. What did they find?
The statistics are, well, they're staggering. They really are.
Give us the headline numbers. What's the big reveal?
Okay, so first, just prevalence. About 31.6% of these patients had overt documented breathing issues. So roughly one in three. and a little more, 37.5%, had the high white blood cell count.
Okay, so both are common, but not, you know, universal.
Right. But when you cross-reference them, when you see who is in both groups, the link is almost absolute. Oh. If you were a patient who had breathing problems, there was a 79.2% chance you also had the high white blood cells.
79%. That is an extremely high correlation.
It is. But look at the flip side. If you didn't have breathing problems, if your lungs were working fine through the seizure, the chance of having high white blood cells plummeted to just 18.2%.
Wow. From almost 80% down to 18, that's a massive gap.
It's a chasm. In medical statistics, we use a term called the odds ratio to measure the strength of an association. An odds ratio of 1 means there's no connection at all. It's a coin flip. An odds ratio of 2 or 3 is usually considered a strong finding, something worth publishing.
So you'd see a headline like, people who eat broccoli are 2 times less likely to get this disease, and that would be a big deal.
Exactly. That would be a very solid paper. This study found an odds ratio of 17.0.
Wait, did you say 17? A 1 and a 7?
17.0.
That can't be right. That sounds like a typo. Usually in these types of clinical studies, aren't we looking for like small single digits? A 17 sounds like a data error.
I thought the exact same thing when I first read the table in the paper. I actually had to go back and double check their math. But it holds up.
How is that even possible?
To give you some context, the link between heavy smoking and lung cancer, which is sort of the gold standard for cause and effect in epidemiology, has very high odds ratios. Yeah. But finding a 17 in a retrospective clinical study like this is functionally a smoking gun. It means these two things are not just, you know, friends who hang out sometimes. They are married. They are intrinsically linked.
So if you see a patient who is gasping for air after a seizure, you can almost guarantee their white count is going to be through the roof. And if their white count is through the roof, you can almost guarantee they were gasping for air, even if no one wrote it down.
Precisely. It's a mirror. Mm-hmm. That's why the title of the paper is so perfect.
But it wasn't just a simple yes or no switch, was it? The study found something more nuanced. It found a gradient.
Right. And this is maybe even more compelling. It wasn't just binary, like, breathing problem, yes or no. The magnitude of the problem mattered. They found a significant inverse correlation between the patient's oxygen saturation and their white blood cell count.
Okay, break that down. Inverse correlation means as one goes up, the other goes down.
Exactly. The lower your oxygen level dropped, the higher your white blood cell count spiked. It was like a seesaw. If your oxygen just dipped a little bit, say to 90%, your count went up a little. If your oxygen plummeted down into the 70s, your count skyrocketed. It tracked almost perfectly.
There was a stat about intubation that really drove this home for me. And, you know, intubation is when they have to put the breathing tube down your throat because you can't breathe on your own. It is the ultimate sign of respiratory failure.
It's the last resort. You have failed to oxygenate your own body.
So listen to this breakdown. They looked at the group of patients with normal or even low normal white blood cell counts, let's say below 9,000. What percentage of those people needed to be intubated?
It was 1.3%, basically zero. If your white blood cell count was normal, your lungs were fine, you didn't need a breathing tube.
Now let's look at the other extreme. The patients with a super high count above 21,000, a number that would make any ER doctor start sweating. What was the intubation rate in that group?
85.7%.
That is just, it's unbelievable. From 1.3% to 85.7%.
It tells us that a white blood cell count of 21,000 isn't just a, that's a bit weird finding. It is a 5-alarm fire. It is a biological siren screaming that this patient's respiratory system has collapsed or is on the verge of collapsing.
And what's so crucial to remember is that the doctors treating these patients at the time, they didn't know this correlation. They weren't using the white blood cell count to decide whether or not to intubate.
No, of course not.
They intubated because the patient was turning blue, because their oxygen levels were crashing. The white blood cell count just happened to align perfectly with their raw clinical judgment.
And that's what validates the biology. The body was reacting to the crisis in real time, and the blood test was just the evidence of that crisis.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the correlation is, I think we can say, undeniable. The what is established, but now we have to talk about the why, because this doesn't make any intuitive sense on the surface. Why would struggling to breathe make your immune system flood the blood with cells? Does the body think the lack of air is some kind of bacteria?
No, it's much more primal, much more fundamental than that. To understand this, we have to look at the mechanism. And the authors propose a really elegant explanation called the catecholamine storm.
Catecholamines?
Yeah.
That's adrenaline, right? And things like it.
Among others, yes. primarily epinephrine, which is adrenaline, and norepinephrine. These are the body's fight-or-flight hormones, the gas pedal.
And we know for a fact that during a grand mal seizure, the body just dumps massive, massive amounts of adrenaline into the system. It's probably one of the most physiologically stressful events a human body can possibly endure.
Huge amounts. Now, usually we think of adrenaline as just making your heart race or your palms sweat. But adrenaline has a profound and very direct effect on the actual architecture of your blood vessels and your immune system.
The study uses a specific word here, demargination. And I want to drill down on this concept because I think most people, myself included, before I read this, we imagine blood as being like a highway. The cars and the cells, they're all zooming around, and when you draw blood, you're just taking a snapshot of the traffic.
That's a very common misconception. And what you're describing is the circulating cool of cells. But that's only half the story, maybe less than half.
Okay.
Imagine that for every single car on that highway, there's another car parked on the shoulder, just sitting there, engines idling, waiting.
And these are the marginated cells.
Exactly. Roughly 50% of your total white blood cells, specifically a type called neutrophils, are in this marginated pool at any given time. They're physically stuck to the inner walls of your blood vessels, the endothelium.
They're actually stuck, like glued on.
You can think of it like that. They're held there by specific adhesion proteins, things called selectins and integrins. You can think of them as a kind of molecular Velcro.
Okay, but why? Why would the body keep half its army in the barracks? Why not have them all out on patrol?
Evolutionary readiness. Think about it. When would you naturally have a massive adrenaline surge out in the wild, evolutionarily speaking?
When a saber-toothed tiger is chasing me, or I'm in a fight with a rival for resources.
Exactly. Physical trauma, a major injury. If you are about to get bitten or clawed or gored, you are about to have bacteria and dirt introduced into your body through a wound. You don't have time for your bone marrow to manufacture new white blood cells. That takes days. You need a fully trained army now.
So the body keeps this massive reserve force glued to the walls of the blood vessels, ready to deploy at a moment's notice.
Right. And this is the crucial part, connecting back to our study. Where are they glued? Where's the biggest barracks? The study highlights that the lungs are the single largest reservoir of these marginated cells in the entire body.
The lungs. Not the spleen or the lymph node.
The pulmonary capillaries, the tiny, tiny blood vessels in the lungs, hold more of these marginated white blood cells than the spleen, the liver, and the bone marrow combined.
That's incredible. So the lungs are basically a giant vascular storage unit for your immune system.
A massive barracks, right where the action is likely to happen, where you breathe in pathogens. So now let's go back to the seizure. The brain goes haywire. It dumps that massive surge of adrenaline. That adrenaline hits the blood vessels.
And what does the adrenaline do to that molecular Velcro?
It dissolves it. Both mechanically and chemically, the adrenaline surge disrupts those adhesion molecules. The Velcro lets go. This process is demargination. Instantly, and I mean within minutes, billions and billions of white blood cells detach from the walls of the lung capillaries and flush into the main bloodstream.
So when that ER doctor draws the blood sample 10 or 20 minutes after the seizure, they aren't seeing new cells that were just made. They are seeing the parked cars that just got forced onto the highway all at once.
Precisely. That's why the spike is so incredibly fast. You can't make new cells that fast. You can only move existing ones.
Okay, this perfectly explains the leukocytosis part of the title, the high white count. But how does this connect to the lungs failing? Is it just that the sudden traffic jam of cells is causing the problem?
That's part of it. But the adrenaline is a real double-edged sword here.
Yeah.
At the exact same time it's flushing all those cells out, the adrenaline is also hammering the heart. It dramatically increases cardiac output, the sheer volume of blood the heart is pumping every minute.
So the heart is beating much faster and much, much harder.
Much harder. So now you have a massive surge of blood slamming into the lungs. But at the same time, the adrenaline is also causing what's called pulmonary vasoconstriction. It's tightening the blood vessels in the lungs.
Wait, hold on. So you have more blood trying to get into the lungs, but the pipes are getting smaller at the same time?
Exactly. You have a high flow state hitting a high resistance state. That creates immense back pressure.
That sounds like a recipe for a burst pipe.
In a biological sense, yes. And this brings us to a very dangerous condition that paper discusses called neurogenic pulmonary edema, or NPE.
Let's break that down. Neurogenic, meaning it's coming from the nervous system, from the brain. Pulmonary edema, meaning fluid in the lungs.
Right. Fluid in the lungs caused by a brain event. The pressure in those tiny lung capillaries gets so high that it physically damages the delicate membrane between the blood vessels and the air sacs. the capillary alveolar membrane.
The barrier that keeps the blood in and the air out?
That barrier breaks. It becomes leaky and permeable. So fluid from the blood, the plasma, starts to leak out of the blood vessels and into the air sacs.
So the patient is, in a very real sense, drowning in their own fluid.
Yes. And that is why they are gasping. That is why their oxygen levels are plummeting. That is why their lips are turning blue. It's not just that they aren't taking breaths, it's that the breaths they're taking are useless because their lungs are filling up with this edema fluid.
And the study's central argument is that the same adrenaline storm that is causing this catastrophic fluid leak is also the thing that kicked all the white blood cells off the vessel walls.
They are twin consequences of the same biological explosion. The magnitude of the adrenaline surge directly determines the magnitude of the white cell spike and the magnitude of the lung damage.
That is such a clean, elegant, mechanistic explanation. It explains the correlation of 17.0 perfectly. If the storm is a Category 1 hurricane, you get a few more white cells and maybe a little fast breathing. If it's a Category 5, you get 25,000 white cells and fluid-filled lungs requiring a breathing tube.
Exactly. And this completely recontextualizes what we see on chest x-rays.
Oh, let's definitely talk about the x-rays. Because the study mentions that the patients with the breathing issues, the PSCRC plus group, they often had abnormal x-rays.
Right. But when the radiologists read them, they use these very vague, nonspecific terms. Things like infiltrates, vascular congestion, atelectasis.
Okay, and if I'm an ER doctor and I see a groggy post-seizure patient with a white count of 25,000 and the x-ray report says infiltrates.
You diagnose aspiration pneumonia 100% of the time. You assume they vomited during the seizure and inhaled some of it into their lungs.
Because vomit in the lungs would cause inflammation and fluid, which on an x-ray just looks like infiltrates.
Correct. And on the surface, that's a very reasonable guess. But the study pushes back on this and pushes back hard. They note that true aspiration pneumonia, an actual infection, takes time to develop. You don't get a massive consolidated infiltrate 10 minutes after the event. Bacteria need time to grow. The inflammatory response takes hours, if not days, to really bloom.
So what are those hazy spots on the x-ray, if not pneumonia?
The author suggests it's that fluid we were just talking about. It's the neurogenic pulmonary edema. It's sterile water, not pus from an infection.
That is a critical distinction, because if you think it's pneumonia, you treat it with weeks of heavy antibiotics. If you think it's neurogenic edema, you might treat it very differently, maybe with supportive oxygen, positive pressure ventilation, or just giving the body time to reabsorb the fluid.
Misdiagnosis leads to mistreatment. If you overload a patient with antibiotics they don't need, you're breeding drug resistance and risking all kinds of side effects. But even worse, you might be missing the actual physiological crisis, which is the immense pressure and fluid shift in the lungs.
I want to pivot for a second to this sort of blame game that often happens in hospitals, particularly around intubation. There's a common belief, a dogma, really, that when a seizure patient stops breathing, it's often the doctor's fault.
Ah, yes, the respiratory suppression theory.
Right. We give patients benzodiazepines, drugs like Atomon or Valium, to stop the seizure, but we also know that those drugs can, at high doses, make you stop breathing. So if a patient gets intubated after getting Atomon, the doctor might think, oops, I must have given too much.
That is absolutely the dogma. It's written in the chart. Respiratory suppression secondary to medication. It's what we call an iatrogenic cause, meaning doctor-caused.
But this study just throws a giant wrench into that entire theory, doesn't it?
A massive wrench. A game-changing one. They looked at the actual medication doses these patients received before they had to be intubated.
And what did they find?
They found that the patients with the highest white blood counts, the ones who were most likely to be intubated, often received low or standard doses of benzodiazepines.
Really? Not the huge doses?
No. Some of them received just 2 milligrams of lorazepam, or even less. That is a completely standard, generally safe dose. It's highly, highly unlikely to cause complete respiratory failure in a healthy adult.
So if it wasn't the drugs that stopped their breathing, what was it?
It was the storm. The body was crashing because of the seizure itself, because of the neurogenic pulmonary edema, the exhaustion of the respiratory muscles, the central apnea from the brain shutting down. The study basically says we need to stop blaming the drugs for a process that the seizure initiated.
That is a huge takeaway for the doctors and nurses listening. Because if you're afraid to give enough Ativan because you don't want to be blamed for intubating the patient, you might let the seizure go on for too long.
Exactly. And letting the seizure continue just fuels the storm. Underdosing is a real risk. the study says. The patient isn't failing because of your drug. They are failing because the seizure is tearing up their lungs. So stop the seizure. Do your job.
Stop the storm.
Stop the storm.
I want to touch on a really nuanced, almost hidden part of this study that I just found fascinating. It's this idea of the relative leukocytosis index. This addresses all the patients who didn't have a massive abnormal spike.
Right, because a skeptic might ask, okay, this is all well and good for the 25,000 WBC crowd, but what about the patients whose white count was, say, 8,000, which is normal? Did they have no storm at all?
Exactly. If my count is 8,000, which any lab report in the world would flag as normal, does that mean my body was calm during the seizure?
Not necessarily. And the researchers did something very clever here. For the patients who had more than one blood draw, they compared the first one, the one taken right after the seizure, to a second one taken maybe 18 to 24 hours later, when the patient had stabilized.
And what did they find when they did that comparison?
They found that even in the so-called normal patients, the first count was almost always significantly higher than the second count. So maybe a patient went from 9,000, which is technically normal, down to 6,000 the next day. Both are normal numbers on a lab shoot.
But the drop itself tells a story. The change is the signal.
The change is the signal.
Yeah.
It tells us there was a spike. It just wasn't big enough to cross that arbitrary abnormal threshold of 11,000.
So the implication is that almost every single generalized convulsion causes a white blood cell spike. It's just a matter of degree. It's a universal phenomenon.
Exactly. It seems to be a fundamental part of the pathophysiology. If you have a grand mal seizure, your white cells will demarginate from your lungs. The only question is how many. And the size of that spike tells you how violent the respiratory stress was.
Now, I'm going to play devil's advocate here for a second, because I know some of our very sharp listeners are probably thinking this. When a patient comes to the ER, what's one of the first things we do? We give them IV fluids, big bags of saline.
Right, to rehydrate them, support their blood pressure.
Okay, but if you pump a liter or two of water into someone's veins, you are going to dilute their blood. Wouldn't that naturally make the white blood cell count drop the next day? Maybe it's not the storm passing. Maybe it's just watered down blood.
That is the classic hemodilution argument. And any good peer reviewer would have asked that exact question. The researchers anticipated it.
So how did they check for it?
They looked at another value in the blood test, the hematocrit. Hematocrit is basically a measure of the concentration of red blood cells.
Mm-hmm.
If you're just diluting the blood with water, the concentration of red cells should drop by roughly the same percentage as the concentration of white cells. Everything should go down together.
And did it?
No. They found that the drop in the white cell count was significantly larger and disproportionate to the change in hematocrit, which means it wasn't just watery blood. It was a real, active, physiological return to baseline. The soldiers were being recalled from the bloodstream and were going back to the barracks on the vessel walls.
That is incredibly thorough. That really strengthens the conclusion.
It really does. It closes a major potential loophole in the argument and shows that this is a specific immune respiratory event, not just a side effect of routine ER treatment.
We have to talk about the ultimate stakes here, because breathing problems after a seizure, they aren't just an inconvenience. They can be fatal. And this brings us to the absolutely terrifying topic of C2D.
Sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. It is the leading cause of seizure-related mortality, and it is just devastating. A patient, often young, healthy, otherwise, has a seizure, often at night, and just doesn't wake up.
It's the nightmare scenario for every person with epilepsy and their families.
It is. And for the longest time, it was a total black box. We didn't know why it happened. But now the research is really starting to converge on cardiorespiratory failure as the primary driver.
So how does this study, this paper about white blood cells, connect to C2D?
Well, we know that most monitored CT paces involve a period of severe apnea and often heart failure immediately following a seizure. And when they perform autopsies on CTP victims, what do they find in the lungs?
I'm going to guess. It's edema. Fluid.
Pulmonary edema, exactly. And hemorrhage. The lungs are described as wet and heavy.
The exact same pathology we are talking about with this catecholamine storm. The same neurogenic pulmonary edema.
Precisely. So the study poses this really provocative and, frankly, very important thought. Could the post-convulsive white blood cell count serve as a biomarker for a near-miss SUDEP event?
A warning shot from the body?
Exactly, a warning shot. If a patient comes into your ER, they survive the seizure, but their white blood cell count is 30,000. That lab value is telling you that they just survived a massive life-threatening catecholamine storm. Their lungs were under immense pressure. They were right on the precipice of that irreversible fatal pulmonary edema that we see in people who die from SUDEP.
It tells you that this patient is in a completely different risk category than the patient next to them whose white count is only 6,000. Even if they both look okay and are walking around now.
It forces you to pay more attention. It makes the invisible physiological struggle visible. Maybe that patient with a high count needs to be admitted for closer monitoring. Maybe they need their seizure medications adjusted more aggressively, because the next time they have a seizure, they might not survive that storm.
That turns a routine, often ignored lab value into a vital risk assessment tool. It's no longer, oh, their white count is high, that's weird. It's, oh, their physiology is screaming at me that they almost died.
Exactly. It's a paradigm shift.
Okay, before we wrap this all up, we have to be responsible scientists.
Yeah.
No study is perfect. What are the holes in this one? Why shouldn't we go out and change all medical practice tomorrow based on this one paper?
Well, the biggest limitation, as we mentioned at the top, is that it is retrospective. They look back at charts. They had to rely on what doctors and nurses wrote down in the heat of the moment.
And doctors are busy.
Yeah.
And their notes can be brief.
Exactly. If a doctor didn't explicitly write patient gasping for air, the study had to code that patient as no respiratory compromise. But maybe they were. Maybe the doctor was just too busy trying to get an IV in or push medications to type a detailed note right then.
So the respiratory compromise group might actually be much larger than the study captured. The effect might be even stronger.
It's very likely, yes. Also, they didn't measure the catecholamines directly. They didn't draw blood from these patients and test for their adrenaline levels.
That would be incredibly expensive and hard to do in a real-time emergency.
Very hard. Adrenaline has a very short half-life. It degrades quickly. So they are inferring the catecholamine mechanism from decades of existing literature. It's a very strong, logical inference. It fits all the biological facts perfectly, but they didn't prove it with a direct blood test in this specific cohort of patients.
And finally, there's still the X-ray issue.
Right. You can never 100% rule out a small aspiration event just by looking at a chest X-ray. It's possible some of these patients did inhale a little bit of vomit, but the sheer statistical weight of the evidence, that 17.0 odds ratio, suggests that aspiration alone simply cannot explain the whole picture. The signal is too strong and too consistent.
Okay, so let's bring this all home. If you're a medical professional listening to this, or just someone who's fascinated by how the human body is wired, what is the big takeaway?
I think there are four key points to really hold on to from this. Number one, high white blood cells after a generalized seizure are common. Don't immediately jump to a massive infection workup. It happens almost every time.
Okay.
Number two, the height of that spike is not random. It matters. The magnitude of the leukocytosis mirrors the severity of the breathing problem.
The gradient effect.
The gradient. Number three, this is almost certainly caused by an adrenaline storm, not an infection. The soldiers are coming off the walls because the body thinks it's in a fight for its very life. And number four, this entire response likely explains the mysterious lung fluid and the urgent need for intubation in some patients. It's a systemic crisis, not just a brain glitch.
I love that synthesis. It really changes how I visualize a seizure. It's
yeah.
not just neurons misfiring in the brain anymore. It's the brain screaming, the adrenaline flooding the system, the heart pounding like a drum, the lungs squeezing shut, and the immune cells rushing into the fray. It's a total all hands on deck body event.
It is a unified, desperate struggle for survival. And that simple blood test is the receipt. It's the damage report.
So here is my final thought for you, the listener, to take away from this. The next time you see a medical chart or hear a doctor on a TV show say their white count is high, don't just think infection. Stop and think deeper. Think about the incredible stress that body has just endured. The authors of this paper suggest that this simple number, the WBC count, isn't just a distraction to be ignored or treated with antibiotics. It is a window into the violence of the storm the body just went through. It is a measure of the struggle.
And recognizing that storm and respecting its power might just save a life.
Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the body storm. It's really amazing how much one simple blood test can tell us if we only know how to read the message. Stay curious, keep asking questions, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.